This is a Hot Pie original.
The Meyer Chronicles, take one. Welcome to The Meyer Chronicles, a Hot Pie Media production. For more information about The Meyer Chronicles, go to hotpiemedia.com. On today's show, Andy Meyer and producer John Rubin discuss the early days of Andy's career in the music business.
Hey, Andy, it is great to be chatting with you again.
Great to be here, and I'm looking forward to this one especially because it takes me back to the 70s and the world of rock and roll in a way that it's never been before, and I've got some crazy stories that no one's heard.
I'm dying to hear them. It's funny, you know, we've done only Hollywood, we've done only films so far, and I'm really excited because today's conversation is very special. It's a little different, and there are some big names and legendary artists who you brushed elbows with and have some great stories about: George Harrison, Joe Cocker, Peter Frampton, Cheech and Chong, and a whole slew of other A&M artists and people who were in your orbit in LA while you were working at A&M Records. So Andy, take us back to the very early 1970s, those first days when, as I understand it, you're right out of college and somehow you land a job working for A&M Records. How did that all happen?
Well, I have to start at Bucknell University. When I was at Bucknell, I was also a college rep. I was repping for Pennsylvania.
Oh, cool.
I produced a whole bunch of stadium concerts with Sly and the Family Stone and the Grateful Dead and the band. And I wrote a book about it called Dancing on the Seats, which I sold to Billboard Publications in Hollywood, and that connected me to A&M Records. In fact, the way I was able to write the book is I was so busy producing concerts that I had a business class with an economics professor, and I went up to him and I said, listen, I really like your class. I just don't have time for it. So I got to do something else. He said, well, you're already in business. You're producing concerts. So why don't you write a paper and like an independent study? And I said, fine. And this part of the story makes my students at SCED go crazy because over Easter week, I wrote an entire book called Dancing on the Seats. I stayed up like 3 days, wrote the book. So the paper I turned in to the professor was then the book that I sold. And on graduation day, I had packed up my VW Bug yellow. They had to be yellow in those days.
That was the only color it came in, right?
Yeah. It was the yellow VW Bug. The big mistake I made with that car was I put air conditioning in it, and those cars are not made for air conditioning. And I blew up the engine a couple of times. But I drove out to Hollywood. I had a job already because of the book as the director of college promotion at A&M Records. And I didn't know much about it. I just know I was skipping graduation, driving across the country, and going up La Brea Avenue. I'd never been to LA before, to the A&M studios. They're now the Henson Studios, but they were originally the Charlie Chaplin Studios, where a lot of his movies were made. And I have to set the table for the story I'm about to tell you of what the physical layout of the A&M Studios is, because you drive in and the parking lot's in the middle, and there's a series of cabanas surrounding the parking lot, and a lot of the Chaplin scenes were shot on the roofs of those cabanas, and all the offices are on the bottom floor or the second floor with a balcony that everybody can see. So I drove in and I parked my little VW Bug in the middle of the parking lot. I was so excited, and I got out of the car and somebody directed me to my office, and I didn't even know I had an office. I said, my office? And then there was a woman standing there and she said, I'm your assistant. I said, I'm an assistant? I was 21 years old, you know? And then I heard a lot of noise and sort of a little crunch, and people were talking, and the assistant said, you better go out there. And my VW Bug had rolled backwards into the Rolls Royce of the famous producer, Lou Adler, who owned Old Records and started Cheech and Chong and Carole King. And there was my VW Bug snug against his Rolls Royce. I was so scared. I ran back into my office and tried to hide. And my assistant, who now thinks she has the worst, craziest boss in the world, forces me to go back out there, find Lou Adler and apologize. And everybody on the A&M lot, because they could walk out on the balcony, saw this. So this is like the first worst impression you can ever give to a company when you arrive at the studio. And that's how it all started for me.
That's really the worst entrance ever, I guess, right?
And then I discovered, and this enters into the crazy world of the early 70s. This is 1971. But I was given a black American Express card with no credit limit and no expense report. And you were supposed to like spend money, and one executive wasn't using his credit card and he got in trouble for not spending money. And I was so naive, they gave me a $400 car allowance. So I went to a dealership and I said, I have $400 to spend a month. What can you get me? And the guy looked at me and he said, we can get a car for you. And I think he sold me a car that was $100 a month, but he took $400 a month. It was a real learning curve. And I had around the country college reps who I had hired to promote the artists. And for me, it was the best job in the world because I was single. I could take a whole bunch of albums, fly to any college I wanted to, spend the weekend, come back, and I was doing my job. And I hired some people who are very well known now. I hired Henry McGee in California, who became the president of HBO. And I hired Peter Greenberg to cover the Midwest. So when I was running the college rep program, these college students got some weird requests because they were dealing with these rock and roll bands who were traveling around. And I got a call from Peter Greenberg, who eventually worked at Newsweek and is now the CBS Sunday Morning Travel Editor and also has a great podcast called The Travel Detective. He called me up and asked me very naively, Cheech and Chong just asked me to buy some dope for them. How do I expense that? And I said, Peter, you can't like really expense it. And we went back and forth on it. And we worked something out. But I've always remembered that story, and Peter's always remembered it. And we became great friends, and we still are for many, many years.
And all those Cheech and Chong comedy albums, then those were on A&M in the 70s.
Yeah. And they toured, and I saw them all the time.
They were awesome. They were huge. I forgot about that.
So one of the interesting things about working at A&M on the lot is there were all kinds of characters there. Sometimes we knew what they were doing, sometimes we didn't. For example, there was an A&R guy, terrific guy, named Alan Mason, who would travel around the world looking for talent. And he was very good at it. He signed a lot of big bands. But what was kind of weird or unique about him was whenever he traveled, he only wore the smallest little backpack. If he was going around the world, if he was going to a big convention, we'd be lugging two big roller suitcases with suits and stuff. And he just always had this little backpack and he would be gone like for months and he would never talk about it. And when I talked to Barry Levinson, he told the director, Rain Man Diner, he told me that Alan was the basis for the Daniel Stern character in Diner, which I thought was pretty interesting. And then we had a manager of a comedian named Wally Amos. And Wally was a sweet guy. And he would always bring to everybody's office these chocolate chip cookies, which he said was his grandmother's recipe. And we all ate them. We all thought they were great. And one day we picked up the newspaper and we saw that he had raised a ton of money. And this manager, who wasn't a very good manager, but a sweet guy, had started Famous Amos Cookies.
I know and love those cookies, actually.
Yeah, and it was just that while he was walking around talking about his client, have a cookie. The cookie was the product, not the client.
That's awesome. I think Famous Amos is probably one of the top 10 most famous A&M artists now that I know that.
Top grossing.
Right, top grossing, sure. Well, I know when you first moved out to LA, you'd said you were living in Calabasas outside of town. And didn't you, you'd mentioned to me once that you had a neighbor who was maybe somebody we've all heard of.
Yes, you've heard of him. at the time, no one had heard of him. His name was Billy Joel. And he was my neighbor in Calabasas. And I was a young record guy. He was a young guy, you know, trying to sell his songs. And we were talking and he told me that he had finished an album, Piano Man, the classic Piano Man album. And he was in a deal that he really wanted to get out of, a record deal. There was a lot of money against it. It was a guy named Artie Ripp, who everybody called the Ripper. And he was committed to a lot of albums. And it was just a bad deal. And he asked me if I could help him. There's a little small window of time because there were a lot of lawyers involved and other people listening to music. So I went to one record executive who I will not name, and I played him the Piano Man album. And his response to me is just another male piano player. which basically ended my career working with Billy Joel because I couldn't help him. And so, you know, I mean, had he wanted to sign Billy Joel, I might have been in the Billy Joel business.
Right.
And not the A&M business, you know? I mean, those are the little moments, wrinkles in time where you wonder if something had happened, would your life have gone a different way? And so fortunately, I had a job, and so it was okay.
Yeah.
So after about a year as a college rep promotion head, A&M asked me to run their publicity department. And like most things in my life, I was unqualified to do that. I didn't know anything about PR, but I didn't know anything about the record business when I started working on the lot at A&M Records. So I'm very good at doing jobs I'm not qualified for. So I took the job. It was the best job and the worst job I ever had, because basically the job was having people yell at you all day long because they didn't like the press they were either getting or not getting. And in those days, you know, the early 70s, computers were just coming on online, and the Hollywood Reporter and Variety, they were all print copies that everybody rushed to read. And because I was the head press guy, I had Variety and Hollywood Reporter hard copies delivered to me at like 5 a.m. And so I would be the first person to either see the good news or the bad news. And then I would have to go and tell everybody, tell the manager of this band that they had just gotten a bad review or a good review. And, you know, they would say things like, well, you have to fix that. And I would say, you want me to drive around to every newsstand and pull the papers? What do you mean, fix that? It's all over town. You can't.
Of course, no one remembers the good reviews, right?
Yeah. But the best part of the job of doing publicity is you met everyone. You met everybody, not only in the record business, but in politics, the mayors, the governors, because they all came through you. So I learned a lot about people who are famous. And one of the things I learned is two things. One is a lot of them are very lonely because they're so high profile that they can't just go out to the store and buy something, you know? They are sort of the precursor of what we're all doing now. They all had to stay home and have stuff brought to them because they were so famous that they couldn't like walk down the street. The other is, and I find this to be really interesting, a lot of people who are famous in business grew up poor. And they know from $0 to $100 what the value of that is because they knew that growing up. Beyond that, you know, I used to work with people where I would, you know, ask for a $50,000 check for something that needed to be done. And that was fine. And then I'd go back to the same person and say, we need to do this. And that person who had just written the $50,000 check started complaining to me about the note cards with people's names on it because it was costing $79 a card or something. They understand $0 to $100, but they don't. $50,000 is just a number to them. So I just find that an interesting factoid.
That's interesting.
So my office was right next to the A&M soundstage, which is a famous soundstage. In fact, We Are the World, the Michael Jackson single with all the famous people, was recorded there. And I was there because my office was next to the soundstage. So I watched the whole performance. And the A&M recording studio was 20 feet from me across the way. And every major artist went and recorded there, and Supertramp did, and a whole bunch of bands. So I had access to just about everybody if I just stepped out of my office.
That's awesome.
And above me in the second floor was George Harrison, because we had just signed a deal with his record company, Dark Horse Records, which is still around today. And next to him was my now good friend, Lou Adler.
Did I hear this right, that you actually had a hand in George Harrison meeting his wife, Olivia?
Yes, not intentionally, but I knew, and a couple of us knew, that George was looking for an assistant. And Olivia was working as an assistant at A&M, and we sort of connected them, and they became lifelong partners.
That's wild. Wow.
We had no idea when we did it. It wasn't like, George, here's your wife and partner for the rest of your life. It was, George, here's somebody who could be your assistant.
Did you see him or meet him? Did you get to know him?
Well, I have a story about George Harrison, which I call young and dumb, because when we made the deal for his record company, Dark Horse Records, we needed a bio, and I was the head of publicity. So they sent me to London to spend some time with George and to write his bio. So I flew first class, of course, because now I had my Black American Express card. And sitting next to me was a very smart, attractive woman. And we now had spent like 8 hours together, or whatever the flight was. And at the end of the flight, I said, we should go have supper or something. And she said, I can't. I'm only in London for one night, and then I have to leave the next day. And I said, well, I have just a one-day meeting, and I'll come back, and we'll have supper. And she said, fine.
And it's with a beetle. Why would you not have told her that? That would have...
This is why it's called Young and Dumb, this story. So I went out to George's house. The car took me out. He had a beautiful mansion on the Thames. And he was there by himself. There was a chef there. And we spent the day, and it was fantastic. He was everything we all know about him. And I got all the information I needed for the bio, but I was thinking about this woman that I had wanted to see. So most people would be thinking about George Harrison. I'm thinking I got to get back for dinner in London with this woman. So at the end of the day, I said, this has been fantastic. Thank you very much. I got to go. And he said, why don't you stay over? We can talk in the morning. He was by himself. I said, I really can't, thinking I really want to get back to this woman. And the image that I remember when I said I have to leave is he got his guitar and he walked up to the front door and he started singing to kind of keep me to stay. And we were laughing and he was laughing and I left. And I had dinner with this woman. And that's how dumb I was.
Beatles fans are very mad at you right now. I'm mad at you.
I was 24 and single and, you know, that's the way it goes.
I think if you told George Harrison, listen, I have a girl in London who I can see once tonight, just let me go and I'll come back. That you should have done. You should have had your cake and eat it too. Oh, well. And what was it like actually promoting these artists? What were some of the things that you guys were dealing with on a day-to-day basis?
We had singles meetings every week. This is sort of a unique part of the record business during these years. Now it's, you know, I'm not involved anymore. Now I'm sure it's all data-based and a lot of formula, which songs come out and go to Spotify. But in those days, it was like the A&R people and the owners, Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss, sitting around picking the single from whatever albums then.
And they were called singles then also.
Yeah, they were 45s with an A-side and a B-side. And I'm not proud of this, but the A&R people always wanted me in the meeting for a reason different than you would think, because they thought I had a tin ear. And if I loved a song, they made it the B-side. And if I hated the song, they made it the A-side. So they always wanted to know what I thought because they just did the opposite of whatever I liked.
That's pretty funny. You may know, you know, my favorite band in the world. They were not an A&M artist, but it's Kiss. They were on Casablanca. And their biggest hit single ever, Beth, was actually the B-side until some radio DJ in whatever town flipped it. So, you know, the tin ear thing, you know, the B-side has value.
Thank you for covering me.
Sure.
And getting rid of the guilt I've had all these years for having a tin ear. I had to wait for this podcast for it to happen, and I'm grateful. You know, the other interesting thing about these singles meetings, and this is where not many people know about this. It's 10 people in a room, A&R people, the owners, and they decide which song goes out. And A&M was a private company. Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss owned it. And they had a lot to say if they wanted a song to be a single. So when the Police brought Roxanne to A&M as a single, nobody thought it would be a big single. And Jerry insisted that it be the single, and it became a monster hit for the band. So, you know, the old theory, nobody knows anything. Jerry Moss knew everything. He had the best ear in the business, in my opinion.
And of course, Sting had a great solo career with A&M, but I'm sure that's for another podcast. Let's talk about some of the people on the A&M roster, and let me know if you have any stories here. Peter Frampton's got to be one of the biggest names on A&M all throughout the 70s. I mean, Frampton comes alive, like, say no more, right? What was that like being at A&M while that thing explodes?
There's an old saying in the record business, one hit forgives a lot of misses, and Frampton came alive, just had A&M blow up. It was so big. Mm-hmm. And one of the indirect effects of Peter Frampton being so big is we really need to cover him more and get more exposure for him while he was blowing up and manage his career the right way. Mm-hmm. So there was a high school reporter named Cameron Crowe in San Diego, and he had hustled his way to work for Rolling Stone. And we thought it would be a good idea to send him on tour with Peter Frampton. And he had also done that before. He had done it with the Allman Brothers as well. And he wrote fantastic stuff about Peter Frampton for Rolling Stone, which was the most powerful music magazine at the time. And that tour and the Allman Brothers tour, became the basis for Cameron Crowe's movie Almost Famous.
That's awesome. Actually, Peter Frampton's in Almost Famous. I think he's got a cameo, and maybe there's a scene at a card table he's at. But I do know that he taught Billy Crudup how to play guitar in Almost Famous to make it look real for all that concert stuff.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And so did you actually spend a little time with Cameron Crowe where at the time you kind of knew like, oh, this kid's going to be something? Could you feel something there?
He was kind of the whiz kid. He graduated high school like 15 years old. And I had met him and talked to him as a 15-year-old Rolling Stone reporter. It was pretty unusual. And everybody knew he was special.
That's cool. Hey, is there a Sex Pistols story with A&M? I know they weren't on A&M as far as I know, but is there some story there? I've heard of something.
Well, they were on A&M for about 20 minutes. What happened was A&M, the London office, signed the Sex Pistols. And everybody in Hollywood, the A&M in Hollywood, thought it was kind of unusual because Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss were great music promoters, but they were sort of not that edgy, let's say. And so it was an odd signing. And at that time, I was working next to Jerry Moss. His office was next to mine. And the Sex Pistols arrived in Hollywood to meet the people at A&M in Hollywood. And it was a total disaster. They were performing outrageous things. They were making a scene. I think they were trying to show their reputation as being bad boys. And I was in Jerry Moss's office when they came in and they were rude and obnoxious, and Jerry basically kicked them out and off the lot, and they were on A&M for like a day. It must be some kind of record.
Hey, but you met Sid Vicious, I guess.
Yeah, I did. I did.
And Johnny Rotten.
I did. And not a big Sex Pistols fan.
So Cat Stevens was an artist on A&M who I'm a big fan of. And do you have any stories, or did you work with him directly?
I do know Cat Stevens. He's a terrific guy. And when he transitioned from being Cat Stevens to becoming a Muslim, which we all respected and honored, some quirky things did happen. For example, every album has a barcode on it with a certain amount of numbers. We printed 1 million copies of the album. And when Cat Stevens saw the album, he looked at the numbers, and now with his new philosophy, he thought the numbers weren't appropriate for reasons we never quite understood, but he was quite determined. And we had to reprint 1 million album covers to change the numbers to numbers that he would approve.
Thank God you guys had a big bankroll, because that would bankrupt a smaller company. Holy
Absolutely.
Cow.
Absolutely. But he was a huge artist for us, and we wanted to do that, and we wanted to keep him happy, and yeah, it was money.
Sure. I know you worked closely with Joe Cocker, and he's probably quite an interesting person to have worked with. Any strange stories or any fun stuff that stick out with working with Joe Cocker in the 70s?
I'm a huge Joe Cocker fan, as is most people. And we had an album coming out with him. I was the head of publicity at A&M Records. And my job was to promote and publicize this album. And I decided, with a bunch of other people, the best way to do it was for Joe Cocker to premiere these songs for an exclusive night at the Roxy Club on Sunset, a famous club like the Troubadour, where bands would go and they would record albums there, and a lot of famous people were there. So we got the most elite press in the world to go to the Roxy for a one-time-only show premiering this new album with Joe Cocker. And there was a lot of pressure on everybody because they would be writing reviews of this album and that would be word of mouth. And so we did a tech rehearsal around noon at the Roxy with Joe and the band and just a few people, just to make sure it was all working great. And I have seen many, many Joe Cocker concerts, and I saw the one on Woodstock. And I can tell you, the performance he did in that tech rehearsal was the best one I'd ever seen, we'd ever seen, but it was only a few people. And I was sort of Joe Cocker's handler. And we went back to the hotel. It's called, in the record business, the Continental Riot House. It's really the Continental Hyatt House on Sunset Boulevard. But that's where all the bands would stay and party. And I took Joe up to his room. We hung out a little bit. Then I had to go back to the Roxy for a technical thing. Then I went back to the hotel and saw Joe. And, you know, we were always worried a bit about Joe enjoyed himself. He's a drinker. But when I got back there, there was an empty bottle of Cavassier, and he was really drunk. And this is now like 4 or 5 o'clock, and the show's maybe at 7:30, and we were trying to sober him up, and he was sort of, well, drunk, I think it's the way to describe it. And he then did the show in front of all these people, and it was a disaster. He got terrible reviews. It was tremendous pressure on me because I was kind of in charge of the whole thing. And only a few of us knew that he had performed one of the greatest shows in his life that day, but it was during the tech rehearsal and not for the audience. So I felt very bad for Joe, and the next day he felt bad, and we all felt bad, and we all moved on, and, you know, life goes on, and he had a fabulous career, but it was just one of those nights that I'll never forget because I saw that show, not by design, but I just happened to be there in the afternoon.
I guess the lesson there is never bring somebody back to the hotel with a few hours to kill, huh?
Never leave a singer who likes to drink alone hours before a show. When you return and there's an empty bottle of Courvoisier, you have to figure that was going to happen, and you should have thought of something in advance. Like, never left him.
So funny.
You know, in looking back on my life in Hollywood in the 70s, sometimes, you know, it's a matter of images. And I have an image in my mind that I've never been able to forget. It's about this situation that occurred. We had just signed the famous blues jazz singer Peggy Lee. Her song Fever is a classic.
Oh, sure.
One of a kind singer. And we decided to do, again, whenever, you know, you're a PR guy and there's an album coming out, you push it with some kind of performance or something. So we booked her at Carnegie Hall, and I went and we put her in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, and a PR man named Paul Block, very famous, nice guy, handled a million people. He and I were sort of in charge of that show. Mm-hmm. And the show was like at 8 o'clock at night. And around 5:30, we went up to Peggy Lee's room, and she was in her bathrobe in bed, basically terrified, hysterical about performing. She's a wonderful person. She just didn't want to do it. But the image I have in my mind all these years later is Paul Block and I are in suits, and we're sitting on the edge of her bed, and she's in a bathrobe, and we're trying to convince her to get up and get dressed and do the show. And that's just like a photograph that I've never been able to forget. She eventually did the show. She was fabulous. But, you know, when you look back at your life, there are certain images that stand out, and that's one of them.
Wait, so that image sticks with you more than the image of George Harrison serenading you while you're driving away to meet some girl?
I don't think they're equivalent.
Because that's the image I have in my head of George Harrison in a robe and sandals saying, Andy, stay. and you already on the highway. There's a lot of life lessons, I guess, here, dealing with so many different types of artists and personalities. I mean, would you say overall this was a really rewarding time for you, or was it also really challenging?
Oh, it's incredibly rewarding. I learned so much. I mean, you know, we've been talking about these sort of odd incidents that are interesting and unique and people like to know about them. But Jerry Moss was known, and still is, as a man who, if he shook your hand, you had a deal. I mean, the contracts would come. But he taught me so much about being fair to people, being honest with people, being real with people. And he and Herb Alpert and a man named Gil Friesen were my role models. And they really carved out my philosophy about business. Be fair, be honest, and, you know, treat people right. And that's how they ran their company. And that's what I've always done. You know, I've only worked for basically four people and then the Savannah College of Art and Design, which is also private. But I worked for Jerry Moss and Herb Alpert, Robert Redford, and Norman Lear. Four men who I respect highly, all of whom had that kind of philosophy. So, you know, these were important years for me.
But I do know you switched gears after the sort of rock and roll 70s, after you sort of had your fill and maybe were looking for a change. You switched gears about 1976, right?
Well, after a period of time doing the PR business, I was burnt out. And I went to Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. I don't know how I had the nerve to do this. I said, I'm taking a year sabbatical. They were so happy for me. They thought it was such a good idea. They bought me an around-the-world ticket. I went all around the world for almost a year, and then I was in Israel, and I got a telegram. Nobody remembers telegrams. From Jerry Moss saying, all right, you've had enough fun. Come on back. But for a year, I had traveled by myself with a backpack, and I carried a typewriter. With that typewriter, I also had, and, you know, people are going to have to Google this, carbon paper, so I could send letters to people and keep a carbon copy and have that as a record of my trip through all these countries. And I have those letters today, and they're one of the bases of a book that I'm writing called The Meyer Chronicles. And the podcast, a lot of the podcast is coming from this book.
And then I know a couple of years later, you're now in charge of A&M Films.
Yeah.
Andy, the music stories, I could do this with you forever. And I'm still not going to forgive you for the George Harrison thing, but we'll get over it. And in the next podcast, we're going to be talking about your life in the film industry.
See you at the movies, John.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Meyer Chronicles, and thank you for listening. To hear more episodes in this series, go to hotpiemedia.com.